My guest in the studio tonight was born in Adelaide. He spent 18 years in London working with some of music's most popular names like Eric Clapton, Sting, B.B. King, Stevie Winwood and Van Morrison. He's led successful jazz funk groups in the UK along with his straight-ahead combos with Jim Mullen, John Etheridge and Carl Orr. His sax can be heard on the soundtrack to the motion picture Four Weddings and a Funeral. He's now back here based in Sydney about to officially launch his debut album, Jason Brewer. Welcome to Now's the Time. Your debut album after 25 years in the business, Jason. Do you see this as a new chapter in your career, or is it just simply a progression of the projects that you have done in the 1990s?
Probably a bit of both, actually. I think it is the beginning of a new chapter, certainly being based back in Sydney, where I lived and worked in the 80s in the pop world. Basically, in sort of R&B bands and such. Even though I was kind of known around as a saxophonist, sort of playing with some of those bands, I was never really known as a solo kind of commodity or stroke artist, you know. And in London, you know, started developing my writing, and as you mentioned, I was involved in a few bands over there playing my own music. So I guess it's a fresh start in some ways being back here after such a long time out of Australia, and an album sort of full of all my own tunes for the first time in a much different vein to what I've done previously. Most of the stuff I've done before, as you said, was more in the sort of funk fusion vein, much angrier. I've got all of that off my chest now, so I'm probably a little bit more mellow as a person, and I think that comes across in this album, and the compositions I think are come from a different place, probably a bit closer to my heart in a lot of ways. But it's impossible for it not to be some kind of a progression from what I've done previously as well. It's a bit of both, really.
Let's go all the way back. You grew up in Adelaide.
Correct.
As a teenager, what was your early inspiration to play music?
Well, I started quite late, really. I dabbled on... I mean, I remember having a drum kit for a year or something when I was about 12, but, you know, I think I had a couple of lessons and then just kind of got bored with that. I listened to a lot of the kind of rock music of the day, you know, all the super groups, Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and Cream and Eric Clapton and the Beatles, of course, and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't actually until I did a stint in London as a 17-year-old when I'd just left school, where I was sort of going out and being able to just go out and see all of those bands that I'd been brought up on. And I found that incredibly exciting. I met a guy over there who sort of introduced me to John Coltrane and Weather Report, and still, you know, never had any kind of feeling that I wanted to be a musician, but I think the seed was definitely sown in that period of 1976, 1977 in London. And then soon after I got back to Adelaide, I was kind of a little bit lost as to what to do. You know, I'd sort of left school early, and then I thought, well, I'll go back to school. So I tried that for a term at a sort of adult education institution. Didn't like that. You know, wandered off to Byron Bay for 6 months, and then I came back, and suddenly it just hit me that I wanted to play the saxophone. And that was it. It was just sort of literally hire a saxophone, and, you know, the next thing I knew, I was sort of practicing every hour, you know, that was possible. It sort of went from there, really. So,
and the tenor saxophone, but it continues to be enormously popular for budding musicians to choose. They can't all be choosing the sax because of John Coltrane. What is it about the allure of the tenor sax continues to be so attractive to musicians?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think part of it, which some people may not be aware of, is the tenor saxophone, the range of it is probably the closest to the human voice. And I think the human voice is obviously the most natural instrument there is. It's purely organic. And I think probably if we're honest with ourselves, we're all frustrated singers, even, you know, I know I am. I mean, I can't sing to save my life, but it's something I wish I could do. And perhaps that tends to have some influence on people, and also I think who you brought up, you know, to listen to. Now, the first tenor saxophone that I can sort of remember really clearly listening to was the stuff on Pink Floyd, which was a tenor saxophone, you know, on the Dark Side of the Moon album, which, you know, was such a seminal album. In fact, they were playing some tracks on it on a station I was listening to on my way to this interview, and, you know, that album was in the charts for 14 years in the States. It's full of saxophone, you know, and then you look at the next album, it's full of saxophone. It's all tenor saxophone, a couple of cameos on baritone. But so I started listening to that, then Weather Report, Wayne Shorter. And this was before I decided I wanted to be a sax player. And I think it was probably Coltrane that sort of...
Tipped you over the edge.
Hit me over the head and thought, right, okay, there's just no going back now. So I don't know, that theory about the human voice is perhaps just something that just sits there subliminally that helps in some way.
All these tunes are written by yourself, Jason. Tell us a little bit about Alfie's Tree.
Well, this is kind of inspired by the sort of North American folk music. I remember an album Michael Brecker made in called 8081 with Pat Metheny, funnily enough, in 1980-81, which featured a lot of acoustic guitar and tenor saxophone, obviously, and a very strong influence, you know, from that North American folk kind of, you know, but obviously with improvising and a much sort of freer approach. I like this space and the sort of openness of it in terms of a vehicle to improvise over. And, you know, it's sort of quite a melodic, you know, sort of style of music, which appeals to me, especially played in a kind of jazz way. So That's the kind of vibe on Alfie's Tree.
Jason, Richard Tognetti, one of the nation's most acclaimed musicians, recently attacked as Neanderthal the current quality of music education in schools here in Australia and urged its swift inclusion on the national curriculum. Now, I know you were involved in music education in the UK and we were talking about the scene over there off-air before, but can you make a comparison as to how you believe Australia compares in relation to how we nurture our potential musicians?
It's a good question. I mean, I was involved in a few different schools teaching music in the UK. I never taught in the tertiary institutions in the UK. I generally taught in high schools and also on a Saturday kind of music school specifically for, you know, for young kids up to about the age of 16. From what I can see in the short time that I've been back in Sydney, I think certainly the Conservatory of Music is producing some extremely talented young musicians. And even though I'm probably biased because I teach at the Australian Institute of Music, I think we're actually producing a lot of extremely talented young musicians as well. I know Melbourne, there's a lot of good programs at the Victorian...
College of Arts?
Yeah, yeah. It has a very good reputation. You know, the quality and the standard of musicianship that is being nurtured in Australia, I think, is very high. I mean, you're never going to get the same numbers as you would as somewhere in the UK. But, you know, I don't know what that criticism was necessarily based on, you know, whether that's based on, you know, the quality of the contemporary kind of popular musicians we're producing, or classical or jazz. I'm not sure what the slur was. I think the standard is very high, generally. I think it's just as high as in the UK, but obviously there's more, you know, people learning music over there, you know, because of the population.
I heard James Morrison interviewed this morning on ABC Radio, and he has his Generations in Jazz thing happening this weekend. Actually, it was happening at Mount Gambier.
That's right.
Well, he asked the interviewer, show me a high school that doesn't have a big band in Australia.
That's so, right. I think there's a very... Look, my local school where my daughter still goes and my son has just left, they've got three or four bands. I mean, I went to a primary school. There was no music program going on at all. I mean, I don't know of any school that I've come into contact with while I've been in Sydney that doesn't have a band program. Some very fledgling, but there are some that are fantastic. And as you said, they all have a big band. They all have the high school that my son goes to has a jazz ensemble, an orchestra, and two big bands, string ensembles, and that's just a very basic, comprehensive public school. I don't know where those comments, you know, what they're based on. You know, there may be some truth in it, but from what I see around me, I think music is alive and well, certainly in New South Wales. Whether there's enough places for those talented young musicians that are going to emerge to play in, that is the problem.
That's the big question.
That is the big question. And that is, I think, a cause for concern.
Let's come back to some of the music you emerged from, I guess. What do you think of the term fusion? It seems to have a bit of a poor reputation in Australia, and some say could lead to confusion.
Well, I think you described my music in the limelight as infusion. I kind of, you know, I think it's something that musicians that train to play jazz at some point get carried away with. I know I did. And I think to a certain extent, a lot of people kind of grow out of it. It's very exciting and, you know, look, there's still, I can still listen to stuff that would be branded fusion and enjoy it. You know, you could call anything that sort of mashes music from different cultures, you could call that some kind of a fusion. So it's one of those words that's perhaps not as descriptive as it may seem. You know, I don't know who I immediately think of when I think of fusion, but I mean, a great band like Weather Report easily be called a fusion band, you know, because they fused rock and jazz and, you know, soul and all sorts of things. So it is a bit of a dirty word at the moment. I've also, it's interesting because a lot of my younger students are now listening to all of this. They're going through the fusion, you know, because it's exciting hearing musicians sort of displaying all of their technique and all of that kind of stuff.
And it used to be the, I guess, the number one way of bringing young people into jazz, wasn't it? They discovered a fusion band and then discovered that, oh, well, Wayne Shorter actually played with Miles Davis.
Correct. You know, exactly. So, you know, that isn't a bad thing. You know, I mean, I think, I don't necessarily think there's any, I don't have an issue with what anybody listens to if it is a way into discovering any form of music that's kind of honest and not contrived. Then that's a good thing. You know, the more music that people listen to, I think the more relaxed, you know, human beings are going to be.
You know? Leaving Home, another tune from yourself, Jason. Does this hark back to the fact when you moved to London or?
Well, it's interesting. I originally started writing this not that long before I left the UK, and then I finished it off here. Leaving Home seemed a very apt kind of title. Then the end of 2007, should I say, I lost a very dear friend of mine called Ian Jones, a fantastic person and a wonderful musician. He was a saxophonist as well, and he lost his battle with cancer at the end of that year. And I decided that I would dedicate this song to him, so it takes on a kind of extra poignancy, and I thought Leaving Home was sort of extremely appropriate for many reasons.
Jason, I might just ask you now a little bit about the band, how you've come to place these names in the band. And I noticed even you've chosen Dale Barlow as a guest, one
Correct.
Of the greats of the saxophone.
Exactly, but you'll notice that he's playing flute.
Playing flute, that's right.
I made sure that he wasn't playing tenor. yeah, look, Dale's a friend of mine. I've known Dale a long time, and I used to see him in London when he came and toured over there, and he often stayed at my house, and I used to get some lessons from him in the old days. And I really fancied some flute on this particular track. I play a bit of flute, but, you know, not up to that kind of level, and I thought, I'll see if Dale's interested, and he was really happy to do it. So that's why he ended up on there. The rest of the guys, there's quite a few guys that are credited in the inside of the album that are London-based musicians, because I actually started recording this album in London.
Okay.
Recorded a number of tracks over there and then redid some of those over here, and then I had some guys do some playing for me over there and then send me the tracks via the internet. So there's been a bit of that going on as well. So I think there's about 13 different musicians on the album. I suppose 75% of those are Australians, but there are a few guys still on there from some of the original tracks that are recorded in London. So it's a, you know, it's very much a trans-global kind of production, and it has been, you know, it took a long time to put it together. It wasn't just going into the studio for a couple of days and recording all the tracks. You know, I spent literally years putting all the tracks together and, you know, sort of cutting them up and redoing them and rearranging them. And you know, it's one of the good and bad sides of having your own domestic studio, because, you know, you have that ability to be able to kind of go, no, I don't like that, I'll redo that, which is good on one hand, but then sometimes it's better to just go in and do, you know, the whole thing live, which is definitely what I'll do the next time round, which was a way of kind of trying to describe the fact that this was recorded in the northern and southern hemispheres and sort of brings in a lot of other things as well. So I'm much happier with that as a title.
What's next on the horizon beyond this album launch for you, Jason? Are you going to be touring this album, or have you got the next one in the back of your mind?
I haven't got the next one in the back of my mind because I've been quite preoccupied with getting this out. I mean, I actually finished recording this and mastering it nearly 18 months ago. So it's amazing that the process of kind of took me a while to find the record, you know, find record company interest and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm keen to get the launch done and then try and get some good gigs around, you know, Sydney and perhaps around Australia. If I can, you know, get on some of the festivals, that would be wonderful. So I know it's not going to be a band that sort of goes out on a weekly basis, but I'm hoping that I can do some good gigs from time to time. There's some good festivals in Sydney that come up throughout the year, so if I can get on those and sort of raise my profile by doing that, then hopefully that'll have some knock-on effect. And, you know, I'd love to get on the Wangaratta Festival. There's a good jazz festival in Brisbane, Sydney Jazz Festival. I mean, they're hard to you know, get on because there's a lot of people trying to get on those festivals, but that's what I'd like to do. So that's the sort of, I'm not going to go any further than that at the moment in terms of what I want to do. I mean, I'm of course do another album soon, but I've got to write it first, so you know, I'll promote this one as much as I can.
So thanks very much for coming into the studio tonight, Jason. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure, thank you very much.